Welcome to another edition of the CSC's Asian Heritage Month. I'm here today with Ruth Chun. She is a lawyer and a cannabis entrepreneur by experience. And welcome, Ruth.
Thank you, Philip. It's great to see you. And thank you for having me here for Asian Heritage Month.
Oh, it's amazing to have you on. We appreciate your time. I want to get into it and maybe ask you a bit about yourself and some of your background and maybe have you introduce yourself.
Sure. So since it's Asian Heritage Month, I will go into a little bit of my personal background. My name is Ruth Chun, and I'm a Canadian-born Korean. My parents immigrated to Canada in the 1970s, and I was born here in Toronto. Professionally, I'm a lawyer. I am called to the bar in Ontario, New York, and very uniquely, Namibia. And I was once a general counsel for a company called NewStrike, which was one of the early license holders for cannabis here in Canada. I'm also a director of a CSE company called Entheon Biomedical, which also has a Korean-Canadian CEO, ironically enough. And then I'm also a lawyer helping various companies from startup to exit, including involvement with the CSE.
So let me just understand this. NewStrike was the company that had the Tragically Hip partnership, if not mistaken, right?
Correct.
Did you ever get to meet them?
I definitely did get to meet them. It was a really interesting regulatory time because the new 2018 Cannabis Act was not yet in force, which has express prohibitions on things like promotions and sponsorships and those types of things, or the representation of a person in the promotion of cannabis. And just before NewStrike went public, we did get a call from Health Canada. Health Canada called and asked, What's this license holder called NewStrike? We don't have a license holder called NewStrike here with Health Canada. And why are they with celebrities called the Tragically Hip? And no, of course, there's no license holder regulated by you called NewStrike. There is a license holder called Up Cannabis Inc., of which the celebrities, the Tragically Hip, are not involved. They are involved as shareholders of the parent company that is listing on the TSXV tomorrow called NewStrike. Brands Limited. And so that's how that partnership was born. And yes, I was involved with them because they did provide a lot of creative input in terms of strain development and brand identity and those types of things. And they were really, really involved, passionate, and wonderful to work with.
Yeah. And so Up Cannabis would have been the private company that listed and then got rebranded to NewStrike.
Correct. Yes. So the RTO process, which I'm sure many on the CSE are very familiar with.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Wonderful. And walk me through that, how you got involved with Namibia of all things. As you mentioned, it's very unique. I don't meet very many people that are do with a lot of stuff in Africa, much less specifically Namibia of all things.
Right. So I think there are very few, if not only one, one lawyer who was called in Ontario, New York, and Namibia. So I was born and raised in Toronto, worked at McCarthy Tetra as a junior lawyer, then for a New York law firm in London during the capital markets boom. And as things started to slow down and there was the crash that happened in capital markets back then, there were lots of other alternative opportunities for lawyers, including going ahead to study, do an MBA, going off to different offices. And one thing that I hadn't done as a lawyer was to do any human rights work. So I had done the study abroad, doing my a semester in Europe, studying Roman Dutch law, which I thought that I would never use because I was a business lawyer based in Canada. But I ended up in a jurisdiction, one of three jurisdictions in the world that actually still uses Roman Dutch law, being Namibia. So I had applied for various human rights opportunities across the world, Southeast Asia, including Africa. And then I got invited to do a study in Namibia looking at domestic violence laws post-apartheid. So there was a Harvard lawyer who was involved in post-apartheid legislation drafting, and she's a wonderful lawyer and legislator. And she invited me to participate in a study, so I went. And then I did the research, drove around and looked at courtroom documents, literally dusty files in remote courtrooms, looking at the implementation of this particular law post-apartheid, wrote the report, and stayed in Namibia for 8+ years, became a partner. Oh, wow. largest law firm and was the go-to local counsel for various listed deals in exchanges around the world, including from Canada. So many companies who had resource deals in Namibia or Southern Africa, for example, metals or oil and gas, I was involved with them as their local counsel. And it was very easy for me to work with them because I was very familiar with the exchanges as well as local laws. So that's why Namibia, and that is still part of my practice just because it's such a unique expertise that I have, and I'm still very knowledgeable of all of the players in the space.
I would think my guess is that there's not a lot of Asian lawyers or Asians in Namibia. Is that correct?
Well, that's an interesting question. There are actually Asians in Namibia, so there are actually, surprisingly enough, North Koreans who are there as workers, very separately on certain government projects. So they are there. I didn't get to interact with him at all, but I did overhear North Korean in a in the hospital once. So that was very interesting. And then there are also Chinese government has bought into or invested in various African mineral resources. So they are there doing various investments and mining operations there in Namibia. So they are there, but not in the same way as they are here in Canada, being integrated and multi-generational.
So what would you say inspired you to work in your field, and what do you like most about what you do right now?
So what inspired me to be in my field is problem solving. So I was actually on track to be an academic. I do have a master's degree, and I very much enjoy theory and reading and writing. And I've re-entered that because now I'm a contributing editor on the cannabis textbook for Canada. So that there's that interest that I had originally when I was younger. And then I realized that I wouldn't be very practical as an academic, and a law degree would allow me to be practical and to solve problems. And I very much believe that. So that's what attracted me to the practice of law and to the study of law. Originally, I thought that I would be a litigator because that's what lawyers do. They research, they argue, they figure out positions, and they try to be cogent and represent their client very well in court. And then I realized what would be more helpful and more satisfying for me would be to find solutions and facilitate success for businesses and other opportunities as a lawyer. So that's how I got into law. I also do some board work, and that came out of just having a deep knowledge of governance and of business. And that's how I naturally progressed into that as part of my career.
Okay, and is if you were to give words of advice for people who wanted to get into your industry or into a similar field, what would it be?
It would be to remember and acknowledge and be who you were before you got into your current position as a professional. So who you were before you went to law school or business school or sitting in that CEO chair or in that director seat, remember who that person is and continue to be authentic to that person. So if you always sang in a choir growing up, continue to do that, right? And just be genuine and authentic. And those things will guide you in terms of really good decision making and knowing whether or not you're following the right trajectory.
That's really insightful, actually. And so how would you say, as being a Korean-born Canadian, how do you think that has shaped your career or who you are today?
Well, unlike clothing or mutable qualities, being Korean is immutable, meaning it's not something I get to choose, right? As soon as I enter a room, as soon as someone looks at me or perhaps reads my name, that's something that's presented, and it's essential to who I am. So whether I choose it to be something I talk about or present openly, it is always part of what's in the room, wherever I am. I think from a heritage and where I come from perspective, I think my family's origin story very much informs how I do things. So, like you, Philip, we've talked about this before, is my parents were immigrants who came here. My father came here with a $400 debt to his brother for his plane ticket. And he was orphaned at age 8, lost his mother at age 2 around the Korean War. And everything he did was on his own. He educated himself on his own, went to the military on his own, and built his own career as an engineer and as a business person therefrom. And so I think that tenacity and that spirit of entrepreneurship and hard work and pride in what you do, I think has really informed me in terms of working hard and, you know, picking myself up when things haven't gone exactly how I wanted them to go, and to keep going and try to do as best as I can.
Yeah, that's really insightful. My parents came into the mid 60s, and you know, my mother is from Singapore, my dad is from Hong Kong. They came to Canada not really speaking a language, and you know, 3 years into being here in Canada, me, my brother, and my sister were born. And in order for them to be able to get to where they do, and frankly, sorry, let me rephrase this. In order for me to get to where I am, we had to have a stable family. And some of the values that they instilled in me in terms of working hard and, you know, just perseverance have helped me personally to get to where I am in my life as well. So I find that that's actually very much a common trait amongst a lot of like recent immigrants and, you know, obviously offspring of the recent immigrants. So if you were to say, like, tell me what are the three most important things that, you know, people should know about your culture, what do you think it would be?
So I think the modern history is actually something about South Korea that people don't know enough about generally. I'm going to make a plug for a book and a now TV series called Pachinko by an author called Min Jin Lee. She's an Korean-born American author. And I think the modern history of Korea, I think, is very telling and something that I think people should know about. It was under Japanese colonial rule, and then also the Korean War, and then very rapid acceleration in terms of economic and social development. And I think having come from oppression in the first half of the 20th century to the fast acceleration and buildup really informed how hard work and overcoming, you know, generational trauma, quite frankly, has led to the success that the country is in now. And then I think you can see that in microcosms such as families, not just Korea, but all around the world. So I think that's very interesting. I think the ties to family are really important. Just like any heritage, any family traditions are really interesting. For example, when a baby turns 1 year old, you have something that's called a doljabi, which is where you lay out various items in front of the baby, representing various career paths. Depending on what the baby picks, that will sort of predict what their future path might be. So most recently in my family, my niece, who is now turning 3 this year, she had a soccer ball to represent athletics, a spool of yarn to represent long life, money for business and wealth, a gavel for law, and then also a toy stethoscope for medicine. And I believe there may have been a calculator for for art, because her mother's a graphic designer, art director. And to my succession planning delight, she picked a gavel. And so we thought it was very funny and cute that she picked law as a successor. But that comes from thousands of years of families doing this at the 1 year celebration of a child's birth, to see their future and the investment I think that families have in their future. And I think that plays out day-to-day in family life and supportive education. Another tradition is the 100-year birthday. So the 100-day birthday, my mistake. And the reason for the 100-day birthday celebration is before Korea was an industrialized country, babies getting to 100 days was not a guarantee, right? So even in my personal family, a generation ago, there were babies in my family who did not live to a year. And so that first 100 days was seen as very important for the mother and for the baby. And then celebrate that they reached the 100 day mark. That's when, you know, they're the most chubby cheeked and chubby legged. And to celebrate that and to bring hope for them to continue on and to grow up. So I think those are interesting parts about my culture.
So personally, do you have any interesting hobbies that people should know about you?
Well, this may be stereotypical, but I will share a hobby, a hobby as well as a neurodivergent. So I do have what's called perfect pitch, which means there's a part of my brain that's overdeveloped, which means that I can recognize and generate notes based on me hearing them without a reference point. So just as you learn colors, and if you see the color blue, you can say that's blue. If I hear the letter A, or if I hear the note A, I can identify it. Or if someone asks me to sing an A, I can identify that. So I've been musical since I was a child, and one of my alternate st streams of revenue is as the local church pianist.
That is amazing. Do you play the organ as well, or just the
Just the piano. The organ does involve pedal work and is, a lot of coordination because it's not just two hands, it's also your feet. So no, I don't. I have a friend who's an organist who I admire very much, but no, just the piano. And just music generally. I also garden. So I generally like old lady habits.
Okay, well, I'm going to pick your brain off camera about some gardening tips because I'm working on my garden at this point too. So, Ruth, next question. Can we talk about role models and representation?
Sure. I love that question. So I grew up in the 1980s, and my role model and representation was Connie Chung on the nightly news. So you've never seen her. And she was the only person who looked like me, who I could see on TV. Everybody else I didn't really have recognition with. Then there was Margaret Cho, who had the first Korean American sitcom called All American Girl. And I had the opportunity to meet her when I was about 18 or 19 in Toronto when she came through Toronto for her I'm the One That I Want show. And I got to meet her backstage. And I did tell her, the significance of you just being on TV and you being in pop culture was just very important, where there was so little representation for me in the 1980s. Now, in terms of pop culture, we've got various shows that are mainstream, like Squid Games, for examples. And then also authors like Jenny Han, who has Up to All the Boys I Loved Before, which has been made into various series on Netflix. I mean, it's really excellent just to see Asian stories being seen as mainstream stories. So I think that, and of course, all the representation, even in the Marvel hero series, to have Asian representation there. I think all of that's important, just so my children, when they see people on TV and celebrities, that they see people that look like them. And then even here on the CSC, Philip, having CEOs who are Asian. For example, Randy Ko of Hempsana, he's also Korean Canadian, and Timothy Ko, no relation, of Entheon, is also a Korean Canadian. So I think seeing Asians in various leadership roles and in the capital markets, outside of just being accountants, if I may just add that, as leaders and as business leaders, I think is really important for the generations that are coming up. And then being a role model to others or a mentor where you can for the generations that are coming up, I think is really important. And still always seeking to connect and be mentored by others is really important within our communities and also outside. So I think that presence is really important.
Ruth, next question. So, what does Asian Heritage Month mean to you then?
So Asian Heritage Month for me is a month of reflection to consider how Asians are part of the Canadian social fabric. I think it's a good time to highlight the achievements and contributions of Asians to Canada. For example, the railway workers who came to build the railway and put down the infrastructure here in Canada. Also, the origins of certain laws and how those took place. We talked about the drug laws and their history with Chinese migrant workers, and also to reflect on current events. I mean, we've been with this pandemic for the past 2 years, and there's been a massive surge in anti-Asian hate crimes, not just in the US, but also here in Canada. I mean, there was a hate crime that took place against an elderly Asian man in Vancouver within the past week. And the percentage rise in anti-Asian hate crimes in Canada is astronomical. So I think this month, reflecting on who we are as a society, including with and together with Asians, in solidarity against anti-Asian hate, and also just recognizing the achievements that we have and that we have together.
And is there, just as a final question, is there anything else you'd like to to tell our viewers and to address? And more importantly, how do people get a hold of you?
Oh. So to get a hold of me, they can email me. It's Ruth, R-U-T-H, at chunlaw.ca, C-H-U-N-L-A-W.ca. You can send me a LinkedIn message to connect, but to actually stay in touch, I think email would be best. In terms of what I think viewers should take away from Asian Heritage Month is awareness of Asians in Canada and how are you including everyone at the table? Mm-hmm. It's very easy and it's very natural to only include people in your social circle and people that look like you. And it's just it's a natural bias that people have. So conscious thoughts about inclusion, who's not at the table, is I think something that should be considered just generally, and then also for really good corporate practice. So I know for certain governance practices and policies, it's very much institutionalized, but I think just generally as a really good business practice, and the studies do show this, I'm thinking about inclusion and succession planning in a way that's very broad and meaningful is something that everyone should give strong consideration.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely, paramount for any type of organization. And then, obviously from a personal standpoint, it's nice to be able to have, because we can here in Toronto and in Canada have people from different ethnicities. And you can, if you want to, have an opportunity to have people from not just Asians, but obviously Africans, Europeans, and you can mix and mingle and create a United Nations kind of mandate for all of your friends as well. So that's nice because it does help with dealing with stereotypes as well as diversity, not only amongst your personal life, but that can hopefully carry on to your work life as well. So I want to thank you, Ruth. This has been wonderful. I've learned a bit today. So once again, I'm here with Ruth Chun. She's a lawyer, she's a speaker, she's very much involved in a lot of legal work as well. And my name is Philip Shum. I'm the Director of Listings Development for the Canadian Securities Exchange. And thanks again, Ruth.
Thank you very much, Philip.